cybercrime, macroeconomic conditions, ESG reporting. You can't predict the future, but you can prepare for it. By understanding your risk, you can make your business resilient to challenges on the road ahead. What's more, you can turn those risks into opportunities. EY helps CFOs, boards, and audit committees see beyond the numbers to uncover the critical insights that make their organizations resilient, even in an ever-shifting landscape. For more insights that matter, visit ey.com/beyondthenumbers.
Is realizing the full value of your network just a dream? Intel is bringing AI everywhere, building solutions to help modernize and monetize 5G infrastructure, making it possible for telecommunications providers to expand services and drive efficiency by reducing costs and saving energy. The next wave of networks starts with Intel. Learn more at intel.com/starts.
You know success when you see it, or you think you do. The people in the spotlight. But what about those small business masterminds who succeed at making their money work harder? They do that by having a business bank account with QuickBooks Money, which now earns 5% annual percentage yield. Making your money work as hard as you do? That's how you business differently. Learn more about QuickBooks Money at quickbooks.com/5APY. Banking services provided by Green Dot Bank, member FDIC. Only funds and envelopes earn APY. APY can change at any time.
This is Bloomberg Business Week. I'm Carol Masser.
And I'm Bloomberg Quick Take's Tim Stenovec. We're here every day bringing you the latest news from the world of business and finance.
Plus technology, politics, economics, all harnessing the power of Business Week reporters and editors.
Not to mention our 2,700 journalists and analysts in more than 120 countries.
You can download Bloomberg Business Week on iTunes, SoundCloud, or Bloomberg.com.
You can also listen to our radio show at 2 p.m. Eastern Time on Bloomberg Radio.
Or watch us on YouTube. Search Bloomberg Global News.
This is my favorite read of the day. I read it in this morning. It's also almost read on the Bloomberg. Yep. And Paul, it's about how the Fed is giving us all a lesson when it comes to lag time.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the Fed is raising rates. They're raising rates aggressively. They've communicated that clearly. But it takes time. It doesn't work immediately. And Alison Schrager joins us. She is a senior fellow at the Manhattan Institute. She's also a Bloomberg opinion columnist joining us on Zoom from the tri-state area. Alison, a lot of folks were expecting, okay, the Fed raises rates, the economy slows, and I would argue, or it seems like, other than maybe the housing market, this takes some time here, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does, because, you know, it's an inflation, you know, your expectations about inflation are in the future. You know, you agree to a rental contract, you agree to a wage increase. This all happens, you know, a year in advance. So that's one of the reasons it takes a long time for Fed policy to work.
What's important, and I have to just put out there, you are the author of a book with a great title, An Economist Walks Into a Brothel, which my daughter swiped off my bookshelf, who is studying economics, so she swiped it. You talk about the importance of expectations. We often talk about that in the financial markets overall, but when it comes to inflation, inflationary expectations, it's measured, we follow it. Why is that so important?
Well, as I just said, you know, when you agree to a wage contract, you agree to rent an apartment, whatever, you know, this is based on what you think inflation is going to be over the next year. So, you know, the monetary policy has shifted a lot in the last 30 years of thinking expectations or how you can influence people's expectations is what really matters and is the most powerful tool for monetary policy. So it's super important.
Well, and just to follow, there's a difference between those expectations being well anchored and unanchored. What's the important distinction there?
Well, if they're well anchored, then people have put a lot of credibility in the Fed. You know, this is one of the reasons why for a long time the Fed was targeting 2% inflation. It was this idea as we'll say it's 2%, everyone will believe it's going to be 2%, and everyone's going to conduct the economy as if it's going to be 2%, and it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. But that all requires that people actually believe the Fed is actually going to deliver 2% inflation, and it seems like they've become unanchored now.
And Alison, you know, a lot of folks are saying this is not your grandmother or grandfather's inflation. A lot of this was kind of due to the supply side issues resulting from the pandemic. And maybe there's a limit to what the Fed can do. And that's probably a valid argument, I would think.
It is. I mean, this inflation has many fathers. So the supply side issues definitely, you know, were part of it. But we also, partially we were following an old playbook in 2020 and 2021, which is to boost the economy, you've got to boost demand. So we had this severe contraction supply and then boosted demand on top of it. So all around, you just got a lot of inflation. And, you know, even if you do have supply-induced inflation, you know, the remedy is often to reduce demand, because that's really sort of a lot easier to control. You know, the government can do things about supply, but I mean, it's even longer lags. As I said, if Fed policy takes a year, maybe more, government sort of boosting supply can take, you know, other than sort of certain trade policies, can take even like more time, like 5-10 years.
So one of the things I also loved in your story is you said the bond market has a terrible track record predicting inflation. If history is any guide, bond traders are the last to know when inflation is about to change, which I feel like, Allison, we spend a lot of time when we're talking with our TV colleagues about the financial markets. Oh, watch the bond market. It knows what it's doing. You're saying not necessarily the case.
I've never understood why that's a thing. I mean, it's that they have a terrible track record of predicting inflation. I don't even really believe inverted yield curves tell us that much. I mean, it's that these, you know, they're just, bond traders are human and they're just as fallible as the rest of us, and they don't have special insight. And in fact, I think considering bonds are such long-term assets, they tend to be very short-term in their thinking.
You know, Allison, this Federal Reserve has been really clear, I think, on its messaging here. I mean, starting with Jackson Hole, you know, if you weren't paying attention that we want to fight inflation, now you better. And they've been very consistent. Is that part of being a good Federal Reserve, is clearly communicating to the market really where you want to go?
It is. I mean, I think it's following this intellectual tradition, that this idea that, you know, communication and setting expectations is the most powerful tool. I think the problem the Fed has is it's a little late. Like, if they were more ahead of the curve on inflation, they might have had a bit more credibility. But the fact they kept insisting it was transitory, they keep in putting out forecasts that suggest inflation is going to be back to like normal in a year, I think really undermines their message. So I think they're now doing the right thing, but it's a little late.
All right. So when someone like a Mark Mobius says, hey, guys, get ready for maybe 9% moves in interest rates, because that's what it's going to take to bring down the current inflation, how do you think about how high the Fed might need to go and how much we need to kind of get our heads around it?
I think 9% is a little high. I agree it would bring down inflation, but in that case, the cure might be worse than the disease. I think, you know, they're definitely going to go above 5%. The inflation number, I mean, the way I think about it is you want sort of the real interest rate to at least be at inflation, so the Fed is still not sort of trying to pump demand. But I would look at core inflation rather than overall inflation, which is inflation minus food and energy. So that's what, about like 6.9% around now. So, I mean, and it might go down just as more supply chain issues ease. So probably I think 9% is a little high, but we could be looking at 5, 5.5, maybe 6%.
All right. Good stuff. Allison, really appreciate it. Allison Schrager, senior fellow at the Manhattan Institute. She's also a Bloomberg Opinion columnist joining us on Zoom, which we appreciate. We get to see her. She's zooming into us from the tri-state area. So good stuff here. It's inflation. It's the Federal Reserve. The Federal Reserve, yes, if you listen to most experts, was behind the curve, maybe still behind the curve, but it's not for lack of trying, at least over the last 6 to 9 months.
But, you know, we keep saying, okay, we're looking for signs for it to come down, but man, is it sticky.
Yes.
In terms of coming down. But she did emphasize, you know, focus on the core, which is something we talk about a lot. Check out her book, too. It's a great title. It's a great book. An Economist Walks Into a Brothel and Other Unexpected Places to Understand Risk.
This is Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Messer and Bloomberg Quick Takes' Tim Stenovic on Bloomberg Radio.
She's an incredible analyst, and she's also a comic.
And she's running around doing the research analyst stuff, doing TV, doing radio, because some bankers reported earnings this morning.
Something called a little company named Goldman Sachs. Stocks up almost 3% in today's trade. Let's get to it with Bloomberg Intelligence Senior Global Banks analyst Allison Williams. She's here in our Interactive Brokers studio. All right. Walk us through, what do we need to know about Goldman?
So number one, trading still is the majority of their business, and they delivered on trading. So fixed income trading up 41%. That
nice.
Led across that. And fixed income trading was the highlight of the investment bank this quarter.
Yeah.
For all banks, it was net interest income. But looking at the investment bank, fixed income highlight, fees the low light.
So how about on the equities business? Because we got an S&P down big this year, NASDAQ down big. Can you make money trading equities in that kind of tape?
I think the activity is helpful, but we're up against a really strong quarter from a year ago.
Okay.
Prime brokerage is a business that benefits from higher asset prices, use of leverage. So as you can imagine, that's not doing as well. But I would say for Goldman, the focus is, you know, what's happening on the market share front. They are one of the top three with Morgan Stanley and JP Morgan, and that race has gotten a little tighter in recent quarters. I mean, in a way, that's all about bragging rights, because they're all as the top three, focused on profitability and doing well. But, you know, Goldman held its own there. And then to the fees, everyone's fees are down dramatically. I mean, broad declines across equity underwriting, debt underwriting, M&A. So pull all the numbers.
I know.
70 to 80% for your old friends that are in that are working away and trying to do deals and unfortunately not getting.
They had a few record year or really good years.
Yes. I mean, last year was truly amazing. I think we were at a record, you know, in the middle of the year.
Yeah, so this is when
Allison, when it's these bad markets, I talk about the pipeline. How's the pipeline at Goldman Sachs? Look, so like if I don't have much to talk to my bosses about, I say, but I got a great pipeline.
Right. And you would be saying that, and you would be saying the same thing since January. The pipeline is strong, and that is the positive things that we haven't seen that sort of take a step back. But the question is, will that get executed? We have a few more days like we've had the past couple of days. If we can get a little bit more rally, does that open up a window to get some of these deals done? I think
Kroger and Albertsons did a deal. Like, there are things happening.
There are. And, you know, it was interesting. If you looked at the debt side of things in August, things opened up. And it was a really strong month on that side of the business. You know, there's a lot of questions around the leveraged loan marks, right? There were a lot of marks last quarter. This quarter, where are the marks?
And you know what? We're also seeing the endowments are starting to report their performance. And they're actually very – I thought it would be down 20%. This is through June. They're kind of flattish. Wow. And what that tells me is, A, they were pretty well hedged, but B, they haven't marked their big private equity investments to date. I wonder if the banks are slow to mark investments because these things got to be down significantly.
Well, there were big marks. I mean, big marks in the context, right? So there were marks last quarter. I think this quarter was less because I think when the window opened up, you know, maybe there were some things that got done. And, you know, a couple banks did give a number. Citi gave a number. I think it was something like $100 million. Last quarter was $126 million. Deutsche Bank and Credit Suisse are going to be the ones we're watching because they're bigger in the leverage business. Deutsche Bank has said they expect something. We'll find out how big that is. But, I mean, for the industry, you know, Jamie Dimon, I think, made the great comments. It's, you know, a fifth of what we were at the financial crisis. So you remember back in those days, that was a real concern, what was going on. Mm. And just because of the size of that business and the size of banks' balance sheets today, smaller business, bigger balance sheets.
So is there some, Allison, net takeaway as we try to kind of glean from what the CEOs had to say and how the big banks performed, what it says about the outlook here?
I would say there, you know, the three takeaways. One is the net interest income, which was super strong. That, you know, third quarter is history, but the run rate is so much stronger coming into the fourth quarter. That's good. As we look into 2023, can the loans hold up? Can the cost of deposits hold up? Secondly, we talked a lot about trading. We think that there continues to be volatility. We think that helps fixed income trading. Fees at least are steadying quarter to quarter, so still down a lot year over year, but we're starting to see some steadying, so that bodes well for next year. The last thing, provisions. That's what we called the wild card coming into this quarter.
Right.
And they were a little bit higher than we expected, but not by much. So I would say tweaking the credit view, and maybe the biggest number that we got or the biggest statement for the quarter was Jamie Dimon saying, you know, if we go to 5 to 6% unemployment, $5 to $6 billion of provisions, you know, that's obviously worse than people expect, but nowhere near what we saw pandemic.
Okay, good to know some perspective.
As always.
Yeah. Bloomberg Intelligence Senior Global Banks Analyst Allison Williams, thank you so much. Really appreciate it.
When cyber criminals strike, the difference between a catastrophic event and resilience is preparedness. Finance leaders who plan ahead can thwart the damage posed by ransomware. Yet in a recent EY poll, only 23% of directors expressed confidence in their organization's ability to respond to a ransomware attack. Cyber preparedness is just one facet of the complex risk landscape finance leaders face every day. Now more than ever, it's vital to keep ahead of developments. Cybercrime, macroeconomic conditions, ESG reporting. You can't predict the future, but you can prepare for it. By understanding your risk, you can make your business resilient to challenges on the road ahead. What's more, you can turn those risks into opportunities. EY helps CFOs, boards, and audit committees see beyond the numbers to uncover the critical insights that make their organizations resilient, even in an ever-shifting landscape. For more insights that matter, visit ey.com/beyondthenumbers.
Success is more than the final destination. It's a path you take one step at a time. It's discipline. It's teamwork. And it's the drive and passion inside of us that comes before all recognition. It's what Stifel's been doing for over 130 years. Quietly, yet strategically, Stifel's become one of the fastest-growing wealth management and investment banking firms in the country. Our financial advisors go beyond traditional wealth management to provide clients with direct access to one of the industry's largest equity research franchises and a leading middle market investment bank. Because success is the drive it takes to keep climbing, the passion to keep investing, the best of each of us made better by the best in all of us. And that is where success meets success. Start your journey at Stifel.com. That's STIFEL.com.
Stifel Nicholas and Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.
Get it.
You're listening to Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Messer and Bloomberg Quick Takes' Tim Stenovic on Bloomberg Radio.
So we know earnings season is getting into full swing, and next week we'll get an update on the business of Meta Platforms. And ahead of that, in a story you can find online at BloombergBusinessWeek.com, how the founder of Meta, of course we're talking about Mark Zuckerberg, isn't saying much about the core platform and business known as Facebook.
Exactly, right.
We're also going to get the truth behind the legs on the avatars in the metaverse. Let's get to this story. It's by columnist Max Jafkin, who joins us along with the editor of Bloomberg Business Week, editor Joel Weber, both in our studio. But Max, let's kick it off with you. Tell us about what is really the focus. We know it's all about the metaverse for Mark Zuckerberg right now.
Right. So Meta, you know, aka Facebook, is a very interesting company right now because on one hand, you have this enormous and very successful, you know, dominant business, which is social networking and advertising. So dominant that, you know, governments all around the world are you know, worried about regulating it, even possibly breaking it up. We saw they'd have to divest from Giphy, a tiny company they acquired a couple years back. And then you have the metaverse, which Zuckerberg is very excited about, talking about all the time, and is, you know, seems to be the, you know, much of his focus and the focus of the sort of senior executives around him. And there really just isn't a whole lot of traction despite tons and tons of spending, you know, and almost mind-boggling sums of money that they're spending to try to make this thing happen.
Is there traction within Facebook for the metaverse?
Well, that is employees? What's you know, super
details.
You know, super discouraging from the point of view of a sort of Meta investor. We saw reports over the last couple of weeks of Meta employees not wanting to use their own product, which, again, that's sort of discouraging on one level because you'd expect and hope that the people who are building this thing are excited about it, but also because Zuckerberg is pushing the idea that the metaverse is going to make a huge difference for office work, right? That it's not just a video game platform. And the reason he's doing that is because the video game business is actually pretty mature. You know, they've been at this for almost a decade. And the fact that they can't get their own employees to use the platform how they say we're all going to use it in the future, you know, doesn't bode well.
Hi, Max. So I wanted to
ask
you.
Are you in Horizon World? Is that what happened? Did we lose him?
Well, I was there for a second, lost in a spreadsheet on my phone, and as you write, soon going to be strapped to my face, that spreadsheet, so I can see it much more closely, I guess.
Ah, the metaverse comes into clarity.
But I do think, like, there's an interesting kind of strategic decision here at Meta of, like, this tack maybe away from consumers and toward the corporate world, and walk us through how that's looking so far.
Right. So if you watched Connect, which is their annual developer event for VR, a lot of the focus was around office work, as you said. And, you know, the big special guests, you know, they had some gaming announcements and they did sort of the usual stuff. But the big get was Satya Nadella, right, the CEO of Microsoft, talking about now you can, you know, load Microsoft 365, which is the product most people know as Office, Word, Excel, PowerPoint. You can do that in the metaverse. The chief executive of Accenture showed up to say, you know, we at Accenture, you know, think this is such a great thing. We've been, you know, doing brainstorming sessions on the Nth Floor, which is the consultancy's, you know, metaverse thing. And again, this stuff potentially could matter, and you can sort of understand from a strategic perspective why Microsoft or why Accenture thinks this is a good idea. You know, Microsoft wants to be everywhere. But
PowerPoints
again,
in the metaverse, yeah, I'm
there. So hey, why not? On the other hand, it's really hard to watch that and think, like, who is going to get excited about this? They're talking about sort of the parts of office work that everyone hates, you know, spreadsheets, management consultants, you know, brainstorming, you know, sessions
the
or whatever.
Floor, where is that again?
You really have to, yeah, I mean, you'd have to be like sort of be a management consultant to like this, which again, okay, maybe there are a lot of management consultants. Maybe that could be a good business, but it just doesn't feel like they're generating a ton of excitement. And when you compare that to the revenue, the amount of spending they've done, we're talking something like $27 billion since early 2019, and they call that an investment. Of course, Wall Street calls it a loss. So we'll see.
Okay, so the headset is another thing that comes up in the story and has been, you know, talked about a lot. It's expensive, $1,500, right? Like what's your take on the headset?
So the headset, it'll be very interesting. You know, Apple is widely rumored. We've reported that they're working on a headset. It'll be interesting what they do. I think the headset was both sort of more expensive than a lot of people who watch the space closely were hoping. You know, $1,500 is three times what Facebook's sort of consumer headset costs. It's kind of hard to imagine somebody upgrading. And then the technical capabilities, it includes eye tracking, which is, you know, very cool, I guess, the company says, for sort of meetings and things like that. But battery life is lower than their cheaper headset. You know, the processing power doesn't seem like hugely better. We even had a Meta employee, you know, John Carmack, who's like a industry pioneer, sort of saying, you know, there are pros and cons to this device, which you wouldn't really want to hear when you're talking about your hot new product that you just released compared to something that you released, mm-hmm. you know, 2 years ago that costs a third the price.
I'm wondering if nothing else, this metaverse discussion has taken some of the attention away from some of the problems that Facebook has with regulators, elections coming up, things like this. It kind of feels like at least maybe an unintentional head fake.
So, or maybe it's an intentional head fake. I mean, you know, one of the interesting things that's happened is you go back 2 years ago, we were heading into a general election, and all Mark Zuckerberg wanted to talk about was the platform's sort of responsibility to society. Right. We saw, you know, Meta talking a lot about, back then called Facebook, you know, talking a lot about election integrity, mm-hmm. Also talking a lot about public health and things like that. Now, what's happened since then is some of those duties have been sort of pushed off to other parts of the company. You know, we have Nick Clegg has been elevated to this sort of role that Zuckerberg, I think, himself was largely handling before. And as a result, you know, all the focus in terms of media attention and from a public policy point of view is on this new thing, which I think has come with some pros and cons. On one hand, Zuckerberg isn't taking it from all sides, like is not maybe being criticized as much, even as there's tons and tons of misinformation on the platform today. On the other hand, a lot of focus on this platform that really doesn't seem to be thriving.
And, you know, breaking up of those election teams that, you know, were sort of a response to sort of some of the sketchy stuff that had happened previously. And, you know, as you write, your kicker, pretty memorable. Got to pay for that metaverse somehow.
Well, and, you know, Zuckerberg just went on Joe Rogan's podcast a few months ago to talk about the metaverse. And that, you know, huge opportunity for the metaverse. But Rogan has been like a prominent, you know, vaccine skeptic. He's somebody who is kind of playing in this disinformation ecosystem. He's like exactly the guy that Mark Zuckerberg 2 years ago would have avoided.
Right.
And now we see Zuckerberg kind of pivoting away from those concerns and to pumping this metaverse, you know, with questionable success.
Well, it's an incredible read, and if you want to find the truth about the legs on the avatar, you're going to have to read the story on the terminal or at Bloomberg.com. Another great story from Max Chafkin, columnist at Bloomberg Businessweek, and our thanks to editor Joel Weber, editor at Bloomberg Businessweek, joining both in our studio. You are listening and watching Bloomberg Radio.
This is Bloomberg Businessweek with Carol Masser and Bloomberg Quick Takes' Tim Stenovic on Bloomberg Radio.
Well, our next guest is an entrepreneur, maybe even a serial entrepreneur. Among the companies he's founded, ThumbPlay, a mobile entertainment service, it grew to more than $100 million in revenue in less than 3 years before he exited the company, which was later acquired by Clear Channel and is now called iHeartRadio. We've got a great guest with us. Ari Truesdell, founder and CEO at the data sharing platform Crisp. They have an interesting mission of helping companies make their supply chains more efficient, reduce waste, and boost profits. So he is here in our interactive Bloomberg studio. So I read about your company. Paul read about your company. Tell us exactly what you are doing and who you're working with.
Great. Yeah. So we work with a lot of large retailers, a lot of distributors, and a lot of large brands. So with the pandemic.
Brands that we know, publicly held companies?
Yeah, large brands, 300-400 large brands on the platform. And they saw during the pandemic and the supply chain challenges that they needed just to collaborate better with the retailers and understand the data better so that they don't run out of products. We all see empty shelves, and we've seen challenges with undersupply and overstock and all of that. And everybody realized during the pandemic and these supply chain challenges that they actually need to collaborate around data to not create waste and also put products on the shelf.
Well, and so, you know, so let's, it's interesting that you say that. So you saw in terms of the demand for your services ramp up in a big way during the pandemic mm-hmm. or post-pandemic.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Before, nobody cared. So I'm fortunate to sell a company here in New York and then traveled around the world and then saw all these challenges with supply chain, especially in the food side, where a third of all the food that's made in the world actually never reaches a consumer, one third. And then another one third is lost when the consumer gets it. So over 50% of the food has no human, it reaches no human. So
no, it's pretty remarkable, right, in a world where people are starving that there's so much food waste.
Exactly, over a billion people. So that was inspiration behind it. Before the pandemic, nobody really cared. And during the pandemic, everybody cared about it.
So, does it stay with us, Ari, like the stress that we've seen on supply chains and companies having to make them much more efficient, much more productive, much more sustainable? Is that something real, or is the sustainability aspect of it just kind of a cool thing mm-hmm. to do, or has something changed?
It definitely changed during the pandemic. And we see all of these challenges in the supply chain. Before, it was easier to manage in a way, but now you see inflation increases, you see strikes, you see labor costs. You see shortages of labor, you see weather, you see seasons. There's a lot of things that is hitting the supply chain. And there might be 100 million companies actually collaborating in a way to get products to the consumers.
Weren't they collaborating beforehand? You know, what's different? Because the collaboration was there. We talk about, you know, the massive global supply chain that's been in existence for decades, to be fair. So what's different?
You know, the whole supply chain runs on technology that was created the year I was born, in 1973. It's called EDI, and that's just purchase orders that get sent through. It's very reactive.
Right.
The ones that are further upstream, they actually don't understand what the consumers are doing. So they get all of these distorted demand signals throughout the supply chain. So they end up producing 1,000 when the actual consumer demand is 100. And then you get what we're seeing now, where all of this is coming in reverse in a way. So now we have overstock and oversupply, and 21% more inventory is actually sitting in the retail chains now because of this. Nike said they had 65% more inventory than they had a year ago. So now it's kind of coming in reverse again from the shortages that we had seen earlier.
Well, so how much of that, though, was companies are in many ways ordering ahead to make sure they weren't cut, you know, found out to be short?
You know exactly what happens. They typically say you run a retailer on the upper east side, you're ordering 100 products. If I'm the wholesaler and I give you 50 products, the retailer smarten up and now they order 200 so they could get 100. If I'm sending that as a retailer or my wholesaler back to a brand again, now they believe that this consumer demand has actually increased, and the brand might have 6 months to actually produce this product. So I might make 800 now, but actual consumer demand didn't change that much.
So based on you, obviously can't tell us exactly who you're working with and all the companies, although we can maybe garner some stuff from looking on the website. But what you are seeing, this supply chain story that has been with us for several years now because of the pandemic, what does it tell you about supply chains kind of getting back to quote-unquote normal, and what does it tell you about the global economy?
You know, I think it's going to stay with us for a long time. I think it's going to take a long time before actually all of this gets worked out throughout the supply chain, because there's always these new disruptions that are that's hitting the supply chain. So I think it's going to stay with us for a long time.
So in other words, there's going to be shortages, and
you're going through the same things. You have too much, and then people
Why is it such a mess now?
You know, there's this theory called bullwhip theory that says that it ripples through the whole supply chain and it gets distorted through the supply chain because the information is not real time. So if you're sitting three or four steps away from the actual retailer, it's very hard to understand if the consumer demand actually went up 5% or if did it actually go up 800%. So that's a systematic problem that will stay with us for a long time.
Just got 20 seconds. Be quick if you could. Are you also seeing that the supply chains are going to be a little crazy and all over the place because people are bringing stuff back home, changing their supply chains? Is that happening
right,
as well?
Exactly. Yep. A lot of changing consumer demand, a lot of e-commerce, a lot of home delivery.
But bringing it closer to where the companies are, nearshoring, onshoring?
Yeah, absolutely. Shortening the supply chains is a big part of this as well. So there's always disruptions that happen, and you need data. That's the thing.
All right, we got to run. Ari, thank you so much. Ari Trousdal, founder and CEO at Crisp, joining us here in our Interactive Brokers studio. This is Bloomberg Radio.
This episode is brought to you by EY. How can EY teams help you create a better version of your company? We work with you to turn data into greater insights, invest to drive growth, and realize your strategic vision through thoughtful implementation. Visit ey.com/reimagine to learn more.
Hi, I'm Ron Kraszewski, Chairman and CEO of Stifel. Financial advisors, if you're not growing your practice, you're losing market share. Stifel is a growing entrepreneurial, advisor-centric firm built for successful advisors like you. Imagine having the resources of the largest wirehouses and the support of the boutique shops, but none of the bureaucracy to get in the way of you serving your clients. At Stifel, it's your business, your book, your clients. I always tell the advisors we're recruiting, I want you to come to Stifel and double or triple your business. Most of them laugh and shake their heads, but I'm serious. Don't take it from me. Take it from Stifel's number one finish in J.D. Power's 2023 U.S. Financial Advisor Satisfaction Study. So, there's a reason why 148 financial advisors joined Stifel last year. Come join us and find out why Stifel is the firm where success meets success. Visit www.choosestifel.com.
Stifel Nicolaus and Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.
I'm driving in my car. I turn on the radio.
How about you let me drive?
Oh, no.
Who's gonna drive you home?
Honey, please, I'll do the driving.
Drive on.
Excuse me, I want to drive.
It's the question that drives us.
This is the Drive to the Close.
That funky music will drive us till the dawn.
On Bloomberg Radio.
All right, this is a very interesting situation. Continental Resources, shale billionaire Harold Hamm's latest offer to take Continental Resources private is still too low. That's according to Smead Capital Management, the oil explorer's largest minority investor. Hamm on Monday boosted his all-cash offer to $74.28 per share, but Smead believes that they should be paying about $90 per share. Let's check in with Cole Smead, president and portfolio manager of Smead Capital Management, joining us on the phone from London. So, Cole, give us, you know, kind of what you think is going on with the company, with their board, with management, vis-a-vis their offer.
Yeah, it's a great question, and thanks for having me on. So, you have to remember that, first off, Harold Hamm is nothing short of a genius in the space. And he's built himself an incredible net worth, and he in many cases has deserved that out of his hard work and understanding the business and being way more aggressive than anyone else. And that, those were all the reasons that we were interested in the business. Now, with the offer he threw in, he's a great card player. It's the kind of person you don't want to be across the table from when you're not on his side. And he threw in an offer that we assumed that he hoped oil prices would back off on. Obviously, not enough. Because he had to raise the price, which we knew was going to be likely. The difference, though, is he raised the price just to please the special committee. It doesn't mean minorities agree with this. It doesn't mean that this is the true value of the business. When we say 90, that's what we'd kind of expect in a fair deal versus what do we think the business is worth? We think it's worth over $100, just so you're aware.
So I'm looking at the shareholder list here on the Bloomberg Terminal. HDS is the symbol when you load in the ticker. I got Harold Hamm, 43% of the outstanding, and then lots of other various trusts and family members here. So they control this thing. What's the recourse for minority shareholders here?
It's a good question. So when this deal was originally announced in June, we had reached out to the special committee's counsel to make sure we get the chance to engage with them, as well as speak with their financial advisor, which was publicly disclosed finally that that's Evercore. Now, that was communicated to us by their counsel. Just so you're aware, that never took place. We never got to talk to either the special committee or the financial advisor. And so when we saw this announced, it was contrary to what we had communicated to us as the largest minority. We provided five things that we were interested to find out where we felt that Continental poorly disclosed. Why can they poorly disclose? Because to your point, when Harold's your largest shareholder and his family controls the business, you don't have to disclose much because you're the shareholder. And so we're still interested. They'll have to provide a filing here in the next couple weeks or so off of, you know, what they're going to be providing in the tender. And we're interested to see the process that the board did or didn't do. We're interested to find out if the five things we flagged to them were actually even considered, because if they're not, you can kind of start to see a dialogue where they might have followed a process to not have a conflict. The question is, do they do their job?
So how far do you take this?
Well, I mean, it's an Oklahoma corporation, so it doesn't follow Delaware Chancery Court. What is particular to Oklahoma is their special appraisal rights under Oklahoma law, where we could take them to court and prove a higher valuation ultimately. So we're interested to see, like I said, what they're going to file in following this. But we have to see those documents first, and we'll probably ask for further information if there's, you know, not enough disclosing that. We again, for how poorly we've been treated in this process so far, I will not at all be shocked if that filing has almost nothing in it, because again, this looks like it's a homer. I mean, you're playing an away basketball game. You ain't getting any calls.
Well, Cole,
the refs aren't on your side.
A couple things here. Having been through this process a few times, the bankers have to do comparable valuations. They have to justify the valuation. It has to trade in line with recent deals, with recent public trading. So you have to do all that type of stuff, number one. Number two, I look at the price chart. This stock's never been north of $80 a share, ever. So they could probably be saying, you know, why should I pay $100?
Well, except that they'd also never owned the Pioneer assets that they bought for a song less than, you know, roughly about 12 months ago. It was disclosed in the quarter that that deal closed that that asset produced $150 million of free cash. That was a year ago, with obviously lower oil prices. So what I don't think either the Wall Street analysts that covered the stock really understood, I think Pam get this, we get this, is that this thing is a cash cow. I mean, what he could do to lever this thing as a private business, he could borrow every nickel of the $4 billion he needs. So, you know, again, he's a great card player. He's not going to give you anything close to fair. Because it's about Harold Hamm in this transaction. It's not about anybody else. And that's where we disagree. That's where our interests finally don't align.
How do you think this is going to play out here? What's the most likely time frame, I guess?
And is there a number you would come down to that's a little bit off your number, but a little bit closer to his number?
That's all part of the process, I guess. And we're, like I said, we're just interested to see what that process was. For example, if someone said, Cole, what would you expect out of this? We would have expected someone to come in and offer. In his filing in June, he said he was not interested in anyone else's offer. Now, he's frustrated that his stock is not being valued like it should be. But he's right in that. We agree with him in that. An all-stock deal from Devon Energy would have been really interesting to us because they have a lot of crossover, same geography as Continental Resources. And what Hamm could be is their large anchor shareholder that Devon doesn't have. And what both companies are doing, what in a way that I wouldn't do, is they're paying too much in dividends. They should be buying back stock. Hamm couldn't do it because he'd be buying too many minorities out. Devon can't do it because they can't find any courage right now. But that would be our dream deal.
Hey, last thought and last questions. I mean, you have a bunch of energy names among your top holdings. Is there a big macro play here for you? I mean, we've certainly seen energy being the outperformer by a mile wide margin this year. And just got about 30 seconds, Cole.
Yeah, no, the energy looks like the easiest game in town in a 10-year period where stocks are going to do terrible. This looks like the 70s. This looks like the 2000s. If you want my other big idea, in our international portfolio, we own MEG. Cenovus buying MEG looks pretty attractive. We own Cenovus as well. We also own Oxy, so we love Buffett being around. We love having billionaires being interested in our ideas.
Who doesn't?
Yeah, exactly.
Cole Smead, fun to spend some time with you and really dig into your holdings, Continental Resources. Cole Smead, President and Portfolio Manager at Smead Capital Management, joining us on the phone from London. By the way, that Smead Value Fund has beat just about all of its peers over the past 5 years, returning on average nearly 12% annually.
And that's saying something. I mean, value's been great the past couple and a half years, but before that, oof.
Thanks for listening to Bloomberg Business Week. Download the podcast on iTunes, SoundCloud, or Bloomberg.com.
And you can also listen to our radio show at 2 p.m. Eastern on Bloomberg Radio or watch us on YouTube. Search Bloomberg Global News.
The countdown has begun. This May, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum, powered by Bloomberg, held in conjunction with our official partners, the Qatar Ministry of Commerce and Industry and Media City Qatar, and premier sponsor QNB. Join heads of state, influential ministers, and leading CEOs to make new connections and gain unique insights. Learn more at QatarEconomicForum.com.